It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Trump administration is pushing for changes to the way Social Security is administered.
Led by efforts from Elon Musk's Doge project, the federal government has reduced staff, announced the closure of offices, and changed policies for recipients of Social Security.
Recipients have reported backlogs and long wait times bogging down the system. Advocates are concerned about what the future of Social Security could look like.
We're checking in on the latest changes and what the upheaval means for the distribution of benefits.
J. Michael Collins is a professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Retirement and Disability Research Consortium, which recently had its funding stopped by the Social Security Administration. Michael, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to the day-to-day here, there is a lot in terms of open questions, right? There were announcements of closures of field offices, including Wausau and Green Bay, from the Doge project. They put out a list. But hold on, the Social Security Administration put out a statement saying, no, we're not closing field offices. The phone system, phone verification was going to end yesterday, I believe. That's been bumped back a couple weeks. What do we know about what we don't know about at this point?
There's a lot we don't know. In fact, I think what we're hearing is ideas that are put forward, then pulled back. We're hearing rumors from staff. We're hearing just all kinds of chaos. And, you know, I think that chaos is part of the plan in some ways. It's just to make the programs face some more critical inspection. And, you know, ultimately we'll see where this lands. But it definitely is difficult, I think, for any of us to know what's going on.
As a baseline, we heard about Social Security understaffing, backlogs before the Trump administration, right? There have been concerns that there weren't enough staff already. What are we seeing as this Doge project goes on, looking to cut more staff from the Social Security Administration and other departments?
Yeah, it's been probably the last 5 years an ongoing story about the fact that Social Security has not been able to staff up their field offices and their central staff to be able to meet the demands of people making claims today. And so that has not changed one bit. In fact, we've seen a lot of retirements, a lot of people with great experience leaving the organization, and not a lot of replacement of those staff. So, you know, we're in a position now where that capacity is even more constrained as people are leaving and as these rumors swirl.
And the Washington Post reported, on top of the staff issues, the Doge project blocked purchases over a certain amount. So in some cases, SSA staff didn't have paper and pens to take notes while they're talking to people on the phone. Are we seeing people who receive Social Security who depend on payments, disability or retirement or what have you, being affected by this?
I think we are. And so part of the problem here, too, is that we won't see it. Like, we won't hear about it. We'll just know that people aren't getting benefits. And so we've seen studies in the past when they've closed offices. It reduces the ability of people to come and get things fixed. And so as a result, they don't get their payments or they don't. They have a claim denied and they never follow up on it. And that hurts the most vulnerable people, the oldest, the most people with disabilities, those kinds of people.
We've seen claims as part of this effort that there's widespread fraud going out in Social Security or waste or people getting money that they shouldn't be getting. How big a concern is that?
It's such a small concern. These fraud accusations have existed for a long time. There's been lots of investigations of this. There are many safeguards in place. So an example is this, you know, so-called vampires receiving payments at 150 years old. It's impossible. There's no formula that allows for that to happen. These people are still on the records, but they're not getting payments. And so, you know, the rate of fraud is such a fraction of 1% that I think those concerns have been overblown.
And one of the latest claims is a lot of legal immigrants having Social Security numbers. This is something that Elon Musk was talking about here in Wisconsin. That is true. Starting in 2017 under the Trump administration, certain categories of legal immigrants working in the U.S. got Social Security numbers. That doesn't mean they're getting Social Security payments.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, that's been the history of the program throughout its entire time. Immigrants have always paid in and never gotten any money out unless they're a country where we have a treaty and allows for that. So it's always been an issue. And frankly, we've all benefited, those of us who are getting benefits, because those immigrants are paying in and never receiving a payment out.
We're talking about latest concerns about the Social Security Administration. UW-Madison professor J. Michael Collins is with us. He leads, among other things, the school's Retirement and Disability Research Center Consortium, funded by the Social Security Administration. That funding in question right now. Michael, what is the current status there?
So in February, you may have seen the controversy where Doge came into Social Security Administration, the acting director at that time resigned because she was unwilling to share information with Doge. They placed another acting director in place, and the day after that person was appointed, our funding was terminated. So there are six retirement and research disability research centers across the country. All six were terminated on February 20th, and we've had to close down now 19 research projects because of that.
What kind of research do you do? Or did you do and are hoping, I assume, to resume at some point?
Yeah, so Wisconsin was one of the six national centers that did research at the request of the Social Security Administration. So Social Security would come to us and say, we'd like a study on X, Y, and Z. So this year we had studies on, for example, multi-generational families. So grandparents who are receiving payments that are supporting grandkids, as one example. Another set of studies were around the effects of long COVID and how people with long COVID can't work, but it's really hard for them to qualify for disability. And so often they just faced severe income shortages. So there's just a couple examples, a lot of work around kids with disabilities and also parents who have children with disabilities and how they can encourage them to have a more economically vibrant lifestyle.
What are the benefits of that kind of research then for the Social Security Administration?
Yeah, like I said, these are all studies that were at the request of the administration. So they vary from helping them design their programs better, being able to do better outreach and marketing and communications, as well as the actuary's office. So the actuary at Social Security has to do projections over what demands are going to be for the next 75 years for services. And so it helps them to think about what those projections look like.
When we've seen these Trump administration cuts, in some cases, a program is canceled. In some cases, it's paused. Funding has paused for a review of some sort. What was the explanation given to your group? What is the status as far as SSA is concerned?
So our grant was terminated. It was not a pause. It was been canceled, and we had to seesaw work, close down all the projects, and that was the end. We are appealing that decision. Mm-hmm. But at this point, all 19 projects, and we also had about 20 graduate students and other emerging scholars that were also terminated in that process too.
So for a lead researcher in one of those projects, they've been presumably collecting data, quantitative, maybe qualitative, I don't know, depending on the kind of work. What's happening to that now?
Yeah, it's exactly what you just said. Data has been collected, but there'll be no more funding for analysis. Students who are working on projects are cut off in the middle of the semester. The projects, you know, part of the excuse of Doge is to reduce waste and fraud. There was a lot of waste. We spent a lot of time starting up projects that will never be finished.
Is there a hope among you and your researchers, whether this appeal or, I don't know, finding other sources of funding that at least some of this research can be dusted off and completed if this end of funding doesn't go on too long?
You know, I think it would be really difficult to restart now because many of the researchers have other priorities as well. And so they're just going to move on to the next research project. And I think that's partly what my concern about on the long run of this is, you know, researchers are going to work where they can get support to do that work. And so the amount of research on Social Security related populations is going to go down. We're just not going to see as much work in this space.
Is anyone, apart from those other members of this consortium around the country, you said there were six, is anyone else doing comparable research?
Certainly this research is going to continue in some form, but the level of funding. So over the last 4 or 5 years, we had about $13 million in funding. That's going to be very hard to replace from any other source. I mean, if you added up all of the foundation money that supports this space, it's not going to be that much.
Now, turning back to the administration of Social Security and what it means for current and future recipients, what are some of the biggest open questions you have right now as we try to sort out where this is all going to fall?
I think for me, I start with the most vulnerable, and those are people who are on SSI, supplemental insurance. So these are, you know, oftentimes people born with disabilities or kids with disabilities who are very, very low income, very, very poor. Have the least ability to navigate online systems to be able to manage their claims or their payments. And many of these people are just going to get left behind. And that's a program I'm particularly concerned about, you know, over 2 million kids that might be at risk.
Right. This system change saying, hey, to verify your identity, we can't do this over the phone anymore. You're going to have to do it online or you're going to have to come to a field office, assuming that office is still open and staffed. That was supposed to take effect yesterday, April 14th, I think, is the latest deadline on that. Do you think that there are going to be people who can't do either of those, who can't manage doing it online, can't manage getting to a field office?
Yeah, we absolutely have seen that in the past where and again, it's going to be the people who are the least able to move about, people with disabilities, older people, people with cognitive problems. They're going to be the most challenged by these systems. And there are you know, programs and nonprofits that will help people. But if you don't have access to those, it's going to be you're going to be very hard pressed to try to get those services.
Now, I've seen reports of a concern among the public, people who rely on Social Security. Do you have any suggestions for people who are concerned now about the future, or the kind of things they can be doing to get ready if the service they've been relying on changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, in some ways, this makes us realize that we kind of took Social Security for granted. You know, it's this protection against disability. It's a protection against the loss of a spouse, of a working spouse. And it's also valuable in old age. And so we all have some stake in this. I think we're pretty used to now talking to our congressional and other representatives about the importance of Social Security. So that's important, more important than ever. But, you know, I think for a lot of folks, this is going to mean taking a closer look at their finances, making sure that they're well insured, that they have the savings they need. You know, this is, I think, causing some real reflection about how important this social insurance program is for all of us.
One other change, it may sound like a small thing, but not sending out paper checks anymore was one of the recent announcements. But also, you can't change your direct deposit status by phone. Is this something that's going to leave people maybe with a gap of a month or two or more if they don't navigate that?
I mean, the paper check transition actually happened about 10 years ago, so I'm less concerned about the paper checks. I am a little more concerned about this ability to you know, manage your account effectively, which you know most of us are used to doing with all of the other kinds of accounts we have pretty easily.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Retirement and Disability Research Consortium. He's with us today to discuss the Social Security Administration cutting funding to that consortium and other changes the Trump administration has made or announced when it comes to that benefits program. Is this affecting you, or is it something you are worried about right now? Tell us about it. Tell us what questions you have, and we can try to answer them. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
On Wisconsin Today, visit two recovery high schools in the state, helping students who face unique challenges in school.
We really welcome those that really need that extra support to get to their next best place.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the first time, the Department of Public Instruction awarded grants to four Wisconsin districts to start recovery schools.
These schools are specifically designed for students dealing with substance abuse disorder. They often include services like peer support and counseling.
Wisconsin currently has one such high school. It is privately owned and in Madison. But the leaders of these other districts around the state hope to better serve students in recovery, and that includes the two guests we have today.
Lee Tennis is the interim superintendent of the Manitowoc Public School District, and Joanna Knoll is the district administrator of the Norris School District. They recently talked with Lee Rayburn.
Let's start with a little bit about your school districts first. And, Joanna, I'll begin with you. Tell us about the Norris School District.
Sure. Well, the Norris School District is a small rural school district in southeastern Wisconsin. Within the boundaries of our school district is a residential treatment center. And so those learners do attend school by us. We also, as residents, we also accept tuition placements as well as open enrollment learners. And through that open enrollment process, we tend to enroll other learners that are being challenged with mental health, alcohol and other drug abuse, substance abuse. So in essence, the learners that we serve are primarily those that have been marginalized, disadvantaged, or have not really been successful in their current school life community environments. So we really welcome those that really need that extra support to get to their next best place.
And Lee, why tell us about the Manitowoc Public School District.
Yeah, so the Manitowoc Public School District is a school district with about 4,500 students in K through 12, sits on the beautiful lake shore of Lake Michigan. Our district has an alternative high school, which is currently a charter school, but next year the charter will expire and it'll become part of our school district. And in that alternative school, we are looking to set forth programming that involves recovery opportunities for our kids more than what we have now, which is very little. We have an off-site program that we use for some kids who struggle with attendance and grades and things like that. Not all of those kids have substance abuse issues, but some of them do. And we really are just hoping to be able to do a better job of supporting them in their recovery.
Yeah, so Lee, let's follow up on that. You're in the beginning stages of planning for recovery school. What's your vision here?
What we're really hoping to do here is provide a comprehensive experience for these kids. If you looked at our data at all on this, only 15% of our students who are in recovery are meeting proficiency in reading, and only 10% are meeting proficiency in math, according to our forward exam. We also have a gap in our attendance. Our students in recovery show that they miss more than 20% of school, which makes it really hard to learn and succeed. And that's compared to about a 12% average for the rest of our kids. You know, with this, what we want to do is provide really specialized instruction for kids that bring in social, emotional support, bring in some community support from the recovery community in Manitowoc. Plus, we also have some partnerships with mental health through Fredert and Lakeshore that we have been using, but not to the extent of supporting students in recovery the way we would like to.
And John and Noel, the centerpiece for your recovery high school is called a recovery hub. And you've modeled this after something Norris is already doing. So walk us through a typical day for a Norris student enrolled in this recovery hub.
Yeah, so I think just a little bit about the idea of the recovery hub. Currently, we are working really on through our virtual school. Norris operates a virtual school called NAVS, and its origin actually came from the need to provide some aftercare when youth were transitioning out of residential treatment or other kinds of mental health supports. And so it allowed us to connect with them virtually. So what we've done is used our virtual school to create hubs of learning in other communities, but they're actually virtual hubs where kids can get together with other young learners who are struggling with the same challenges. So through that recovery hub, we currently are operating a hub in Milwaukee called Learn MKE, and that's in conjunction with Wisconsin Community Services. We're hoping to continue our partnering with other nonprofits across the state, actually, to be able to build hubs where learners that are struggling with recovery or school credit, they're behind on their pathway to graduation, that we would have these hubs of individuals. And in each of those hubs, we would be partnering with a nonprofit or a community organization that actually supports the recovery of young learners. And then we would use those learners would actually participate in our regular programming, which is very learner-centered and trauma-invested. It really starts with every learner developing a learner profile and a deep understanding of who they are and who they want to become. And then from that profile, they meet with their advisor and build out their own learning journeys. And in the case of the Recovery Hub, those learning journeys would reflect academic opportunities, it would reflect community-based opportunities, as well as opportunities to gather and work with mental health professionals, some support groups, peer support groups in their community. But every learner's journey will be different. So a typical day, to get back to that question, they may meet with a mental health community expert during the day, let's say on Tuesdays and Thursdays is when they have their appointment. Maybe every day at 10 o'clock, the kids get together and do a peer support group. Maybe on Wednesday morning, they have their advisory conference with their advisor, and they're building out their learning journey. So what kinds of things can we embed you in your community doing? What kinds of networks and connections can we help you build that will help you post-graduation? So in essence, every learner's journey would be different and unique. Some competency attainment in the academic areas could be virtual. Some of it could be one-on-one online. Some of it could be evidence of community-based learning.
So the program's incredibly individualized for each student and caters to their own needs. How would you make that? How do you make that possible in a small rural school district? And how can larger school districts apply this model?
If we're a very iterative organization, so in our kiddos turn around about every 15 months. So we basically say we have to reinvent ourselves every 15 months or 3 to 6 months because we have to do things differently to meet the needs of our learners. We started by just the learner profile and going through an orientation process when our learners join us is absolutely key. Then we restructured our staff, and everybody is interdependent, but they have very unique and different roles. So we have learning specialists who are multidimensional. They can support learners in competency attainment in multiple subject areas, advisors who help kids think beyond. And so if you think about a learner and you think about in a conventional high school where you might have, say, 15 to 25 learners in a class, maybe 5 or 30, depending upon your organization. Instead, we actually have an advisor, and a lot of that learning, instead of being in those face-to-face classes, is being done by content area experts in the community. So we're relying on our partners who are, you know, if we have a young learner who wants to become an underwater welder, we are connecting with the local welding shop, and that person is helping us deliver that instruction, and we're conferring with them. So our staff take on very different roles. How could other larger districts do that? Simply by breaking young learners down into smaller groups and just redesigning the roles that our staff have and how they do that. I think key to this is helping kids understand what are their hobbies, talents, and interests. So we hired navigators in our district who help kids do just that. They expose them to all kinds of things, take them on experiential opportunities in the community to help them find that thing, which is what young learners in recovery need as well. They need to have coping strategies and mechanisms. They need to feel that there's something there that's meaningful for them. So we try to help them find that, simultaneous to whatever mental health supports or recovery supports they might need.
We're talking about schools dedicated to serving students with substance use disorders. Recently, the state awarded 4 school district funds for implementing the program, and we have 2 of those schools with us today. Jonna Knoll is the executive director and district administrator for Norris Academy, and Lee Tennis is the interim superintendent of the Manitowoc Public School District. Lee, I want to ask you, you both mentioned the importance of community partners in this program, but what role do you see parents playing?
We want to get parents in on the ground level of this as well. So interestingly enough, this is a new program for us. So we're in really the planning stages. Over the next several months, we'll be working together to plan. And so right now we're organizing essentially an advisory team, which will be made up of students, parents, school counseling team, our administrative group, and a couple of teachers as well. And we certainly want to look at other models and programs that have been successful in our state, like Jonna's, and we want to make sure that, you know, we're looking to folks who've done this before and who've had success, because our goal here is really to provide our students who struggle with recovery an opportunity to rebuild their lives so that they can succeed academically while also receiving critical recovery support. We have systems in place currently to help kids catch up, for example, with credits. We have interventions to try to help them attend school more regularly. But the missing piece in this is that support in their recovery. And so we really want to engage families in this and student voice. We really feel like the students who do suffer from issues of recovery and mental health disorders, they should be engaged through this planning process to ensure that their voices are heard, particularly in how the recovery support services and academic programming can best meet their needs. I love how Jonna's program does, you know, things with the community. I'm taking notes over here real vigorously, actually, on all the awesome ideas that I just heard her talk about. And maybe we can also connect offline so I can get more.
Let's do that.
Because it's quite impressive what I just heard you talk about. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, and Lee, what do you expect success to look like from the perspective of a student who is going through the process of recovery? What will success be for them?
Well, for us, I think it's several things. Obviously, we want results for them. We want them to gain confidence as learners. Oftentimes, students who are suffering with these types of issues have a hard time being in school. They certainly, you know, they avoid it. They have struggles academically because they're not there enough to learn and be engaged. They shy away from things like co-curricular opportunities. And I really think for us, it's going to be, you know, checking in with their social and emotional well-being. That is going to be a key piece to determining the success of the program, as well as academically. You know, when we're only having 15% of our kids show proficiency in reading, we're definitely going to be looking at those numbers as well, because we believe that if we can tailor our educational experience to meet their needs in recovery, we can open the doors to learning at a much greater in a much greater way for them.
And Jana, you are looking into a roadmap for recovery, which may be what Lee's looking for here, a training guide for staff. What are some of the best practices that you've learned?
Well, I mean, we're still really digging in on this, and that will be part of one of the outcomes of this planning grant for us, is to really finalize or at least get our recovery, our roadmap to recovery, to its next best place. But it will include things about, like, if we are going to be partnering with community or nonprofit organizations, what kind of memorandums of understandings do we have, and how do we build a pathway to graduation? How do we use community resources as part of that pathway to graduation as creditable experiences? And then most importantly, in that roadmap to recovery, what kind of training and coaching do our staff need to help support learners? We really truly believe that learners in recovery, and research will tell us this as well, they need open and honest communication. They need to be learning in a safe, supportive environment. So they need to know and trust that we are there for them. And so that has to do with building a culture, a learner-centered, trauma-invested culture. We know that we'll need to help educate them about the effects of substance abuse, and actually connect them with resources within the community that can help them navigate that. We talked about coping mechanisms earlier. We've definitely learned that coping mechanisms are important. So if they can explore their hobbies, talents, and interests and have a purpose and passion to get them to their next best place, it kind of overtakes some of the other needs that they're having. And then also, like we mentioned earlier, connecting them to community resources. But also an important part of the program will be a peer support network. All of the learners will meet in small groups of maybe 3 to 5 young people who will be able to support each other on their journey as well.
And Lee, as you continue the planning stages, the Manitowoc Public School District Recovery School, what are some of the big questions that you have that you're looking for the community, students, and faculty to answer?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's helping us identify the needs and some of those partnerships. I think that, you know, one of the things that hits me the most in the data that we looked at in terms of the need was that 70% of our students in recovery reported feelings of isolation or a lack of peer support, which is significantly higher than our district average of 25%. So for me, I'm going to really be looking for ways in research-based ways and ways that we can connect it with the community to help build that feeling of support in general, not only from our school personnel, but also their peers.
You called them kiddos earlier, John and Noel, and I am curious about who these kids are and how you see them.
Well, we actually look at every learner as their own unique human individual, and we really try to look at things with an asset-based mindset. And every learner is unique. So yeah, kiddos, because we just feel like part of our culture is really about making and creating a large family, right? So we all go by our first names. We all interact with each other. We make ourselves vulnerable to each other. So for me, kiddos are just our young learners, because we, our learning network, that learning team that support them are also learners. So often we We call ourselves all learners, but we often use the language kiddos simply because we care, we're compassionate for them.
You also use the language family, which seems to fight back against the isolation that Lee talks about finding among these students.
63% of the youth that we serve are justice system involved. Almost 80% of them are identified with disabilities under IDEA. 89% of our kids are credit deficient. You know, 84% of them are probably struggling or are identified with other mental health challenges. So these are kids that truly need a family. They need a community to be there and support them. And we really try to make our hubs, our main hub out in southeastern Wisconsin on our Norris campus, we try to make that a safe place for them, a place where they can feel trust, where they feel trust and they can make themselves vulnerable. And they need that to get to the next best place. They need to feel that there's somebody there that's on their side. And that's what families are. You know, families are always here to support you. So for us, success is really helping every learner getting to their next best place and continuing to have a plan about how they're going to do that. And our family is how we do that.
Yeah. And clearly both you and Lee see each of these learners as worth investing in.
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Jana, Lee, thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Jana Noel is the district administrator of the Norris School District. Lee Tennis is the interim superintendent of the Manitowoc Public School District. WPR's Lee Rayburn recently spoke with two of the four schools across Wisconsin that were awarded state funds to start recovery high schools supporting students with substance use disorders.
If you or someone you know is struggling with substance abuse and looking for assistance, you can call 211 to find programs in your area.
Milwaukee philosopher and poet John Cady has a new poetry collection and talks about his process.
My poems start in the shower, where I, you know, kind of come up with a line or two, and I write in small bits, maybe two to at most 10 lines at a time.
The book is called Cemeteries and Galaxies. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new poetry collection by Milwaukee philosopher and poet John Cady comments on the human experiences of time, life, death, and even math.
This is Cady's 13th book of poetry. This one is called Cemeteries and Galaxies. Here's how Cady thinks about those two words.
The cemetery kind of alludes to the privacy that we have while we're alive and which vanishes with our death, and the galaxies alludes to the kind of vast impersonal universe in which we're situated.
John Cady is a distinguished professor emeritus of philosophy at UW-Milwaukee, and he joins us from his studio in Milwaukee. John, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The first line in this book of poetry is a question. Where did it go wrong? And in my head, it triggers, okay, where did what go wrong, John? What do you mean? Why did you begin with this question?
Well, I just feel that it's a kind of time of a certain kind of disillusionment, but the poem goes on to talk about how it's not that anything in particular went wrong. It just seems like a free-floating anxiety and disillusionment that seems to settle in, maybe just as you get older, or maybe it's an artifact of our time. I'm not sure. It's just a kind of generalized sense.
I appreciate how questions pop up all over your poems. And when I read them, that question mark feels like a little more personal, like it's speaking to me. And I'm wondering, how do you view writing questions in your poems?
I guess I'm always wondering about things, and I'm never sort of confident in any conclusions I draw. So there's one poem I think that points out that one of my favorite phrases is, and yet. So as soon as I say something, I immediately have second thoughts and start to qualify it. And it's just the kind of cast of mind I have. My temperament is basically inquisitive, but I'm not so good at resolving these kind of questions and uncertainties.
I wonder if that's the philosopher in you coming out.
I think it probably is. I mean, that's really what philosophy, where it begins. And in fact, I wrote my graduate dissertation on skepticism, which is the idea that we don't really know anything about the world. I mean, I was opposed to arguing against it, but that's one of my main philosophical obsessions. And I think that's true of most philosophers.
I was struck in the poem My Privilege when all of a sudden Jasper Johns appears in this poem. And I was like, Jasper Johns, you mean the flag artist,
yes.
The big American flag artist.
Yes.
And so I paused and it's like I just first had to take that moment in and then realize, well, I just need to get more into this poem here. Can you talk a little bit about that poem, the relationship between poetry and visual art and Jasper Johns in this moment?
Well, Jasper Johns was closely associated with some friends of mine when I was in graduate school, and he was also a friend of my favorite poet that was so important to me, John Ashbery. And a few years ago at the Whitney, there was a big retrospective exhibition of Jasper Johns, and it talked in the catalog quite rightly about how private his work is, that there are flags and there are targets and there are beer cans, and they're all mundane public objects, but they seem to have some private significance for him, which isn't disclosed by the work itself. And that's what I began thinking about. The impetus to most of my poetry is this private sense of what it's like to be alive, that you alone have, and it seems like the most special thing in the world. But of course, everyone has it. So in a way, it's also the most commonplace thing in the world. And that's what the poem is about. There was the catalog for the show included some complaints about how Johns was, you know, a white Southerner, and yet his work doesn't sort of address his racial privilege, which is true, but that's because his work is addressing his privacy, not his social situation.
I wonder what privacy means to you as an artist and a scholar.
Well, it's the condition of human consciousness that you are acquainted with the world of your awareness, but in some sense it's private to you and you're the only one who has access to it, but it's true of all of us. And that's really the main theme of my work, this kind of sense of conscious privacy, as well as wonder about one's relation to the world and to time.
Do you have a special place that you write, or do poems come to you anywhere? What is your process like?
My process is once I sort of have kind of an idea or some lines that come to me, my poems start in the shower. I write in small bits, maybe 2 to at most 10 lines at a time. And I'll get out of the shower and sit down at my desk and work on those lines and keep fiddling with them until I like them. And then later in the day before dinner, I'll have a martini and look at the lines I wrote in the morning and fiddle with them some more. And that'll be it for that day. And then the next day, I just pick up in the same way in the shower, then at the desk, and then later in the day, revising. And I keep doing that until the poem is finished. I don't usually have a sense of where the poem is going to go, except in a very general way. In fact, I once wrote a poem, the title poem of a book of mine called The Constructor, in which it was over 200 lines long, and I started with the last line and then worked backwards line by line until I got to the beginning. And it was a marvelous way of feeling that you were discovering what the poem was about. But that's the way I write, in increments.
I like the rhythm. You have a rhythm to your day, a rhythm to how you proceed through poetry. And it sounds like it's not rushed or it's not exact. You can kind of just go where the poetry goes through the course of your day.
That's right.
We are talking with poet and UW-Milwaukee Distinguished Professor Emeritus John Cady. His new poetry collection is called Cemeteries and Galaxies. John, you brought a poem from this collection to read, and would you read Against Materialism for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I should say a little bit about it. It has an epigraph from the early 20th century German mathematician David Hilbert, and it also alludes to the 20th century logician Kurt Gödel, who proved one of the most important results in the history of logic back in the 30s. Gödel was a very strange figure, and he was firmly against what you think of as a materialist view of the world, and that's what the title is alluding to. The epigraph from Hilbert reads, "That Schmidt, he didn't have enough imagination for mathematics. Now he has become a poet. For that he had just enough. Against Materialism. I think I knew Schmidt. He preceded me in his fascination with mathematics and poetry and his weakness of imagination. But that's all I can tell you. Gödel said the axioms force themselves on you as true in a way to be explained, which doesn't recognize your name at all. And I believe that poems can do that too, though beyond their solitary refuge from the world, I'm not aware of any deeper kinship. He said his highest ambition in life was pleasure of cognition, and I guess I felt that too, though never with the intensity he did, that takes what the imagination gives it and then makes it real. He included, materialism is false, on a list of things to keep in mind in case he happened to forget them. And suddenly it seemed to me in my embarrassment that of course those things we want to talk about are real, for what else could they be? And it's not just numbers and minds and other things we think we have to try to work around, but history, as it simultaneously imagines and explains us, social worlds we reify and live in, things so commonplace it's easy to forget how strange they are, like books and DVDs, new kitchens and the budget plans we buy them on. These things make up the furniture of the world, and if none of them pass muster metaphysically, so what? It's enough that what we think of them be true, that we can separate fact from fiction, thought from superstition, axioms from angels. As for the holy grail of what there really is, Horatio, instead of less than meets the eye, I like to think there's more in my philosophy than I can dream of or imagine, though I can't take credit for it, since it's what I found and went along with, and it would have happened anyway. Rest in peace, sweet Schmidt."
John, thank you so much for reading that poem. I'm trying to wrap my mind around what is the intersection of poetry and math and philosophy? What does that connection look like?
Well, actually, about when I was about halfway finished with the book, I realized what I was actually up to in these poems. I had a very religious upbringing, Catholic upbringing, but that rapidly fell away in junior high school and high school. And it was replaced first by a kind of secular romanticism and then by an obsession with modernism. And we usually think of modernism as something having to do with art and literature, but actually I think it pertains to both mathematics and physics and to philosophy. And I know a lot of people think of them as incompatible with each other, but I never have. I've always thought of first physics and then math and mathematics and then poetry and then philosophy, all as different aspects of this obsession with what it's like to have an awareness of oneself and the world and one's relation to it. And I began to also to feel that modernism was really kind of falling away and may be over, that it's been replaced by an increasingly social consciousness in poetry and a kind of identity conception of poetry.
How does that track then when you talk about privacy?
Well, it doesn't. The social issues are a more recent development, but the poets and artists that modernist artists that influenced me so much and that I, you know, aspired to were people like T.S. Eliot and Wallace Stevens, and I've mentioned John Ashbery, Marcel Proust. These are all the important influences on my work and my outlook. And as I say, I think it even pertains, though it's kind of hard to go into, to things like physics and mathematics as well.
Are there constraints in philosophical thinking or in the discipline of philosophy that are freer to you in writing poetry or in poetry itself? Or are there still the rules that you feel give some definition to poetry?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I published about 2 years ago a book called Thought and Poetry, which is really various essays about largely about the relation between philosophy and poetry. And even though I've kind of softened this view somewhat, I think that both poetry and philosophy can start out from the same sources with a wonder and puzzlement about, say, the nature of the self and the mind and its relation to the world. But philosophy is subject to a lot of constraints and disciplines. It has to be logically consistent and coherent, and it has to start with a well-defined issue or questions, and it has to propose answers to those questions and then consider objections to those answers, and then it goes back and forth in that way. Poetry can start out with some of the same wonders and worries, but it's not constrained in the same way. So that, for example, in philosophy, there's almost no one subscribes to a certain view of the mind called dualism, though I myself actually do in a funny way, but not a strange way. On the other hand, in poetry, you can indulge yourself in dualism to your heart's content. You're just trying to figure out what it's like and what it means to sort of think that way. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. I think both poetry and philosophy can start from the same questions and wonders, but philosophy is subject to more constraints than poetry. And that's what the essays in this book really so try to develop.
And in your poems as a reader, I mean, I'm grappling my way through, maybe along with you at times. I feel some of that togetherness, like we're working through things here together from a reader's vantage point as well.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because that's what I try to do. I mean, I try to start with some worries and then work through them and change my mind about them as they go along.
John, thank you for the conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for having me.
That was poet and UW-Milwaukee Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Philosophy, John Cady. We talked about his new poetry collection, Cemeteries and Galaxies. Cady will host a reading from his new poetry collection at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on Friday evening. Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Department is warning about a scam that a lot of people are seeing on their phones. The scammers send texts claiming that the target owes money for unpaid tolls on highways in various places.
These are scams. Don't reply. Don't click those links. Kate, have you gotten some of these?
I have, and I promptly deleted, but it did cause me to rummage through a desk drawer to find my Illinois toll iPass, which hasn't been used in quite some time. Sorry, neighbor. How about you, Rob?
I've been getting these, but this weekend for the first time, I got one from the claiming to be from the Wisconsin DMV.
Oh, no.
Wisconsin, unpaid tolls. I've spotted the flaw in this scam. We don't have tolls in Wisconsin.
Well, let us know if you are seeing these or other scams popping up on your phone. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.